And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hi there, this is The Athletic Football Podcast, and it is Match Week 14. Hi there, I'm Adam Leventhal at the Athletic HQ in London. This is the hub where the magic happens. And I am alongside Tim Spears, who makes an emotional return to the weekend preview. Where the hell have you been?
What emotions are we talking about?
I am excited, but I can see from your face that maybe you are less so.
I'm into it.
Apathy's an emotion, I suppose.
It's good to be back.
It's great to have you on the show again. Have you been well?
No, that's why I've not been here.
Oh, really?
We don't need to get into it, but yeah, it's just had a couple of weeks being ill.
Oh, dear.
But here I am, I'm back.
Oh, well, it's good to have you on board. And you're not infectious?
No, it's all... Oh, yeah. Luke's looking
I'm
for
now,
like...
I'm now wishing I hadn't chosen the seat next to Tim.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You're okay.
No, I'm clear.
Luke Boscher, you heard a little preview there. Luke Boscher, who is a black belt in karate and also part of the Athletics news team. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. I can't complain at all. And based on that knowledge, you should maybe watch your tone towards me, Adam.
Thinking the same thing. Last time I was giving you a little bit of a hard time. I was pushing my luck and now I'm backing off. Nick Miller, meanwhile, you're back again. How are you?
I'm all right. I haven't really been ill. Don't have a black belt in karate.
What's your superpower, though? Okay, should we go through the fixture formation? Yeah, are we ready? Yeah. 5-5 setup this week over Saturday and Sunday. And we actually had a 5-5 2 weeks ago, which Tom Harris said last week that it was only the third time that it had happened in 7 years. So I'm just wondering if maybe he was either wrong or we're just getting lucky that it is come around so soon once again. These are the Saturday 3 o'clocks. We have three of them. It's 11th against 17th, Brentford against Luton. Then the leaders Arsenal take on 12th place Wolves. It's a basement battle between Burnley, bottom of the table, and Sheffield United in 18th. Then on Saturday evening, 5:30 kickoff, it is Forest in 13th, still with Steve Cooper in charge, against second bottom Everton, still licking their wounds. And then beyond the Saturday evening, we have a late kickoff. We have 7th against 6th, Newcastle against Manchester United. Then on Sunday, 4 2pm kickoffs, Chelsea in 10th against Brighton in 8th, 3rd place Liverpool against Fulham, who are 14th. Then we have the London Derby, West Ham against Crystal Palace. West Ham in 19th, Palace in 13th. And then it is Bournemouth in 16th against 4th place Villa. And then Sunday, 4:30, it is 2nd place Manchester City against Tottenham. And that is where we're going to start the show. So the champions, the treble winners, host Tottenham in Sunday's late kickoff. Spurs, a bit of a bogey team. For City, they have won, which is quite remarkable, 5 out of their last 7 games. But they were under different managers, the likes of Conte and Mourinho. Tim, obviously you cover Spurs. Is Ange Ball and that new approach... He flinched already. It's good to have you back on the show. Flinched with me saying Ange Ball. Do you think that this sort of new approach is equally well-suited to facing City, or do you think that his setup is actually going to put them in a little bit of a dicey situation?
I don't think there are many examples of a team beating Man City that way, especially away from home.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't write them off. I mean, Spurs are the agents of chaos, and you know they've got 10 players out potentially. I would say 6 of those would be first 11 players playing in emergency positions. Emerson Royale at centre back. And I guess the question that's sort of been doing the rounds from a Spurs narrative is they've lost three in a row. They've got all these players out. Should he be changing his style? You know, from this sort of high octane, balls completely out, like trying to overwhelm the opposition with like pace and overlaps and vertical football and overloads. And it's sensational to watch, but they've lost three in a row. So given he's not got the players he wants at his disposal, should he be changing his principles? Which is a big question.
Well, what do you think?
I don't think he will. He's never done that in his career. Even when he was at Celtic playing Real Madrid in the Champions League, you know, he never sacrificed that attacking approach, that really high-risk approach. So, and I've got to say, you know, against Villa last week, Villa in a great run of form and they're a very good team. Spurs were the better team. And they registered their highest XG of the season, three offside goals, missed a couple of really good chances, and they should have won that game. And if they had won that game, then everyone would be saying, well, Postecoglou's genius because they've got more than half a team out and yet they can still beat Villa, as they should have done. So I'm interested to see what approach he takes, but it'll probably be, let's go for it, mate. Mm. And it'll be really interesting to watch.
Do you think if three defeats becomes four, that becomes an issue? Does that start to force his hand? Does it put any pressure on him whatsoever?
Yeah, it's one of those, isn't it, where, you know, this, they went 10 games unbeaten to start the season and now they've potentially might lose four in a row. But it's just perception. If those defeats had been muddled in around and Spurs were fifth after 14 games playing some amazing football and got all these players out, everyone would be saying, wow, this is a fantastic start. Keep it going, Ange. But because it's 10 unbeaten and then it's four defeats, you've got to, people look for deeper meanings and a
but
crisis.
There is a sympathy, isn't there? And sympathy because of the injuries.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. You take any first-choice centre-back pairing out of any Premier League team and they'll struggle. You then take the entire midfield out as well.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous what they're going through. And he obviously hasn't got his squad yet because he's only been there a few months still. So he's having to rely on the likes of Højbjerg, who's, you know, shunned at the start of the season, really, to a backup player. Eric Dier, who may come back in at the weekend. Emerson Royal at centre-half, like I said. Gio Lo Celso came back in last week. Brian Hill came back in last week. These aren't players that he would necessarily want to use. So I have a lot of sympathy for him. And also I have admiration for the way that he's sticking by his guns. Because like I said, they were fantastic against Villa last week. And I think they can do something at Man City.
They keep on losing after taking the lead early. Is there a reason why that is? And does it reflect that maybe he doesn't adapt in game, doesn't sort of manage the game well?
Maybe. I mean, those three games, you had that Chelsea one where they...
That was... Maybe take that one out of the mix, yeah.
Then they went to Wolves, having lost six players in a
tough
week.
Tough place to go as well, isn't it?
Real tough.
Yeah.
And they sort of tried to... They scored very early and tried to battle their way through it. And looked like they were going to do that until 93rd minute when, you know, fell to that incredible, incredible defeat.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there. No, I missed it. I was in Lisbon that weekend, but I did watch it. Not sure if I can say if I enjoyed it or not.
Tim enjoyed it.
And then last week, yeah, again, well, they felt unlucky to me, the way that they were creating so many chances and missed a couple. So I don't know. There's probably a level of they go into games so hard, trying to overwhelm the opposition from the off, get a couple of early goals and blow the opposition away, that they use up so much energy at the moment with players who aren't used to it because they've not been in the team and they fade late on. That certainly happened against Villa.
Okay, so we will see how they go against Manchester City. Let's concentrate on the City side of things. Nick, if I can come to you, they've drawn their last two. Chelsea just prior to the international break. Liverpool last weekend. I mean, it seems maybe a little bit silly to say that they need to get back on track. But I suppose Pep Guardiola will have those high standards that he'll be thinking, well, no, come on, look, we can't let it slip too much because Arsenal might be able to pull away even further. They might even be further ahead by the time they kick off.
Yeah, and there was also they obviously came back to win against Leipzig in the Champions League, but the first half was pretty calamitous. It's just the thing that people have said an awful lot about City, but it just feels like they're just waiting. You know, like how the best sort of 800 metre runners or 1500 metres runner will kind of sit in the pack at some point, third or fourth back, and then in the final lap will just kind of effortlessly sprint on ahead of everyone else. So it feels like City are just kind of waiting to do that, waiting to when they traditionally go into sort of God mode in February, which will be probably around the time that Kevin De Bruyne is back. So,
are you the first person to compare Pep Guardiola's Man City to Steve Cram?
Could be. Yeah, could be. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I think if they are even remotely in touch by the kind of third of the season, then they'll do what they always do and win the league anyway.
It's an exciting battle, isn't it, Luke, with Pep Guardiola going up against Ange Postecoglou. Do you think that he'll be relishing this challenge?
Yeah, I think we've seen from Guardiola during his time at Man City that he has kept evolving tactically to stay relevant and stay ahead of the chasing pack, really. You know, we've seen it most recently with this kind of, you know, three centre backs formation, then playing, you know, John Stones in midfield alongside Rodri, and kind of making the best use out of Kyle Walker's immense physical assets. And I do think he will be motivated by trying to beat Postecoglou because he's one of the best managers, I think, in the Premier League this season, and certainly one of the most fashionable and likeable and tactically innovative. But I think City have struggled a little bit, I think, in recent weeks especially, with their kind of defence. I think Josko Gvardiol hasn't really hit the ground running. Struggled a lot against Chelsea a few weeks ago. Nathan Ake has been very good, but struggling with injury. Ruben Dias still doesn't quite look there to me. Maybe not fully fit. And obviously John Stones spent that time out earlier in the season and then has had a little injury. And when he doesn't play, City do tend to struggle. And Manuel Akanji is a fantastic defender, but in midfield, I think, especially against Liverpool, we saw, you know, his passing range, his positioning, it's not quite at the level of John Stones. So, you know, as Tim was saying earlier, I do think the way Spurs and Ange play, I think they can definitely get at City.
Would you like a quiz?
Yeah,
always.
Luke?
Sure.
Okay, good. This is the question. Erling Haaland scored his 50th Premier League goal in 48 games last week. He's never lost once he's scored, and that's after 32 games. Four players have longer streaks. Who are those four players?
I think I know one.
Okay, go on then.
Hey, Gabriel Jesus?
Correct. So Gabriel Jesus is one. He played 55. He won 50 and drew 5, which is an incredible record, isn't it? Any other guesses? Three more to get.
Can I have a stab at the one that is inactive?
Yes.
Ruud van Nistelrooy?
No. Not Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Dwight York?
No. I'll give you a couple of his clubs. Well, he played for England, played for Aston Villa, and he played for Manchester City.
Gareth Barry?
No.
James Milner?
Well, yes, but he wasn't the one that I was thinking about. But he has played for both of them. James Milner is one of them. James Milner played 54 games, won 43 and drew 11, having scored.
But he's not the one you would...
No, and he's not the one I was thinking about.
So there's another Villa, Man City and England player.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Is... Duras Vassell?
Yes.
Wow.
Correctamundo. Played 46, won 36, and drew 10, having scored. Now, one final...
Is it Darius? Right, this is the thing. Cause I met him and interviewed him a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And asked people's opinions before. Is it Darius? Is it Darius? It was inconclusive, so I just said, mate. Oh.
Did you ask him about his blogging career when he was in Turkey?
No, I didn't.
Do you remember this? He used to write these kind of quite bleak blogs. He'd say things like, I'm sitting in my car outside a supermarket and I'm just tapping out this blog on my iPad because I haven't really got anything else to do. And it was, fair play to him for, you know, going abroad and experiencing new culture and a different league, but it sounded so bleak.
Right, sorry to break in. We have one more answer. And I'm looking at you, Tim. I'm surprised that you don't know.
Pedro Neto?
No, he scored in many games and lost.
Yeah, I was going to say. Why are you looking at me?
Because I like the colour of your eyes. No, I'm looking at you because I think you might know the answer.
Okay, wow. No.
Heavy double tap on maybe it's a former Wolves player.
Oh, Jota.
Exactly. Diogo Jota. Played 36, won 30, drew 6, having scored. So those are your four. Jesus, Milner, Vassell and Jota. Should we do some more straightforward predictions for this game? We're talking about Manchester City against Spurs. Go ahead, Tim.
I think Spurs will take the lead and give them a fright. Okay. But I think City will relent 3-1.
3-1. Luke?
I'm going to go cautiously 2-2.
Okay.
A Desmond.
Thank you.
I think City are going to absolutely batter them. I think it's going to be like 4 or 5-1, maybe. I think they're going to get battered, but I don't think it's going to mean anything ultimately because, you know, it's this just quite odd period. And we're not really going to know how good Spurs are probably until, I don't know, the new year when Maddison and Van de Ven and, you know, some of the other players are back.
Okay, jolly good. Right, next up, we are going to be talking about Newcastle and Manchester United.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So Manchester United heading to Tyneside, 8 o'clock kickoff on Saturday night, and they will remember vividly losing 2-0 there last April. Now check this out, if Newcastle win this one, it will be the first consecutive league wins for them since 1972 against Manchester United.
That is
a stat and a half.
I'm surprised at that.
You are, yeah. And these two sides having differing emotions coming out of their two games in the Champions League this week. Obviously, Newcastle were on the verge of winning against Paris Saint-Germain until that controversial penalty. Manchester United, they were leading out in Galatasaray, but they threw it all away and it ended 3-3. Where do we stand on this? Newcastle will just be happy to be at home amongst their kin, won't they, Tim?
Yeah, particularly given the huge amount of effort they put in midweek. I mean, it's remarkable, really. They're completely down to the bare bones. Couldn't even make a sub, could they, on Tuesday night in Paris. And, yeah, I think a trip away pretty much anywhere would be a massive ask. We saw the Bournemouth game before the international break. They looked completely dead on their feet, and you can see a similar scenario this weekend. But I think the home crowd, under the lights, as they say. Yeah. But, no, I think that will have sort of a galvanising effect, and the fact that the game is on Tuesday night rather than Wednesday will be a benefit to them because, yeah, that'll be a real tough one to get over.
Obviously, there's been a lot of coverage of the controversy out against Paris Saint-Germain, the handball from Livramento, and I was speaking to Jacob Whitehead, who covered the game. He was out in Paris just before we came to record this podcast, and it's basically coming down to a differing interpretation according to the UEFA rules rather than the Premier League rules. They don't think that if it deflects off your body and hits your hand, according to UEFA rules, then that's an issue, and that's why the penalty was given. However, the guy who gave the decision has been taken off his next game, so it does perhaps suggest that he did make the wrong decision. In these sort of scenarios, Nick, do you think it genuinely has a galvanising effect, or can it equally have an effect of just sucking the life out of you and thinking, oh, you know, it was an injustice, and that can have a negative impact?
There's going to be a huge amount of teams being galvanised this season if, you know,
that's true.
If ropey VAR decisions go against them. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you kind of think they need something because, you know, as Tim said, completely down to the bare bones. I think this game could be pretty entertainingly chaotic because both of these teams are going to be absolutely knackered, like emotionally as much as anything. I don't think you're likely to see a hugely high quality football game, but I think it will be enormously entertaining nevertheless.
Yeah, it has all the makings of a good game. And I guess, yes, they might have to just sort of park their emotions, Luke, after the Champions League and concentrate on what they did last time out in the Premier League. Manchester United, impressive in a really difficult environment at Goodison Park last week. And then obviously Newcastle were really dominant against Chelsea. So both teams can just try and sort of go, well, look, let's just forget about all that and crack on with our league form.
Yeah, I think Nick does have a point, though, about the quality of the game we can expect. I think both teams, especially Newcastle, have struggled with injuries of late. As Tib said, they didn't make any substitutions against PSG, and Man United's squad is pretty thin as well. So I'd be surprised if there are wholesale changes from the teams that played midweek, which I think, you know, doesn't lend itself to the players being fit and fresh and under the lights at St James's, as Tim said. I think Newcastle might just have the edge, but it's going to be very difficult to call. And I think both sides will come into it with wanting to prove something after the midweek. But it's very difficult.
And both teams, Tim... sorry, go on.
I was going to say, there's a nice opportunity if Spurs do lose at Man City the following day, that one of these teams will be in fifth place in the early standings. And in fact, both of their struggles in Europe are going to potentially hinder them going forward, because the coefficient, as people may or might not know, which could give an extra Champions League place for fifth place in the Premier League, which is where one of these teams might be come the start next week, it's their struggles in Europe, which is slightly putting that coefficient ruling not quite as cut and dried as maybe we would have thought at the start of the season.
There are some good young players being given an opportunity due to both teams' injury issues. I mean, we've got through a weekend preview without mentioning Garnacho and his amazing goal. Obviously, he is someone within that Manchester United side that you now think, right, well, stick with him, give him as many opportunities as you can.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those players who requires a little bit of patience. I wonder whether the next few weeks United will start to kind of, not regret is the wrong word, but that whether that overhead kick is going to make him try similar things every possible opportunity and more often than not hoof them into the stands. Under Erik ten Hag, they haven't been a sort of always a hugely entertaining team to watch, and he is obviously a very entertaining footballer to watch, certainly from a neutral perspective. I imagine he can be quite infuriating if he's on your team.
Yeah, he's in good form. Go on, Tim.
Was it the best overhead kick in Premier League history, though? That's my question to you.
Well, I watched a compilations of these things. I watched one of those. I completely forgot. Do you remember Andy Carroll's one?
That was very good.
Which I've forgotten very, about, very which was enormously satisfying.
How many overhead kicks have you seen live?
I was there for Cristiano Ronaldo's for Real Madrid against Juventus in the Champions League a few years ago. And that's the best goal I've ever seen live, which is a little bit upsetting given it was Cristiano Ronaldo. But I was also there for, do you remember Emre Can scored one against Watford?
No way.
Yeah, I was there for that actually.
Yeah, I was there for that one.
That was
as well.
Great, yeah.
Do you remember Gary Cahill for Villa against Birmingham?
Yeah.
It's like, because it's very unique the way that he gets himself in the air and then sort of kung fu scissor kicks it in.
I think on that centre-back scoring bicycle overhead scissor kicks, whatever you want to call it, I think Philippe Mexès for AC Milan years ago, he scores it from basically like the edge of the box. It's absolutely, and I think, I'm trying to remember the context, I think it was like a game winner or something, which adds, I think, further spice.
We haven't mentioned Wayne Rooney, obviously, and his overhead kick. If you had to pick one as your favourite or better, was it Garnacho or Rooney?
Yeah, I think it's Garnacho, yeah.
Garnacho?
Garnacho, on technique.
On technique.
Garnacho.
And Garnacho. Yeah. Because there is that perception that Rooney shinned it a little bit. But hey-ho. We haven't talked about Newcastle's youngsters. Lewis Miley is one that has obviously been particularly impressive. We mentioned Livramento, who shouldn't, you know, have that game overshadowed by the fact that he was involved in the handball. He's been impressive as well for Newcastle. We're hoping for no more VAR controversies in this one, but let's have a very quick prediction from you, Tim.
2-0 to Newcastle.
Luke?
I'm going to go the other way. Newcastle, you have struggled after Europe this season, I think, bar that 8-0 over Sheffield United. 2-0 Man United.
Score draw.
2-2,
I think.
Thank you. Up next, we're going down into the basement. Burnley against Sheffield United. So this is the battle of the unofficial bottom two. Everton, of course, do sit between them after their 10-point deduction. The stats really do make grim reading for these sides. Only one win each. Sheffield United have only led for 44 minutes so far this season. Burnley have been behind for 563 minutes, and they are both league-high numbers. and Burnley could become the first team in English Football League history to lose each of their first 8 matches at home in a single campaign.
I love that. We're not talking any 1992 nonsense here. That's all-time stat.
Yeah.
Nice.
Do we think that Vincent Kompany and Paul Heckingbottom are just sort of fearing going into every game? Or are you just thinking, well, maybe they're relishing the challenge? Or do you think it just must be an attritional existence for both of them at the moment?
The latter, I think. If I was in that position, I'd just be kind of wanting someone to put me out of my misery. So it's just a sort of drudgery rather than fearing losing another game. It's just kind of, Christ, what's going to happen this week?
It's interesting, though, because Vincent Kompany appears outwardly facing to still be relishing the challenge, still saying that we can do this, you know, slowly building towards getting another victory. Do we feel that Burnley rather than Sheffield United are more likely to pull through, or are we just resigned to both of them just going straight back down?
I think we expected more from Burnley this season. I don't think anybody's surprised that Sheffield United are where they are given lack of investment and lack of quality and losing good players from last season.
Yeah.
But Burnley, I think Kompany will be utterly dismayed, to be honest. And there's a huge question coming up for Burnley. You know, if they lose this game and continue to lose and they're on 4 points from something approaching 20 matches, then is that tenable? Does Kompany want to get out of that? His reputation's taking a huge hit right now. He's been linked with a Spurs job in the summer, touted as a Guardiola successor. It doesn't look like that, you know, right now.
What do you do if you're him? Do you actually go, would you ever walk away from it because it's getting too bad and the damage to your CV is getting quite great?
Potentially. I guess he's got to look at what he wants to do for the next sort of few years, because if it looks like Burnley are near certainties for relegation, does he want to stick with them? Does he want to try and get them back up next season and try all this again and get into some kind of Norwich, Daniel Farke, you know, purgatory? It's a big question for him and for Burnley, really, as to why this isn't working and where they go next.
I think it would be an interesting hit for his reputation if he did walk away, though, because I think that says something.
Yeah, there is.
That would say something about his... I mean, not that I'm coming for it, but it would say something about his character if he was just like... You don't often get managers resigning, leaving clubs in pretty poor situations. And I think we're seeing with both Sheffield United and Burnley and Luton to an extent is that, you know, clubs that are coming up almost look like they're just preparing to go straight back down again and do that sort of Norwich-Watford thing and not bother spending loads of money, you know, like Fulham did a few years ago and then going straight back down. Burnley did spend, you know, 100 million, I think, close to, which sounds like a lot of money in this day and age, but is it really? And some of their signings, I think, quite shrewd, you would say. James Trafford, Aaron Ramsey, signing young English players that have huge resale value if they do go down. If I was Vincent Kompany, I think I'd be kind of looking at Burnley as a more long-term project, something that they get relegated this season probably, and then they go again with largely the same squad next season in the Championship. And, you know, those players they've signed, I think they barely signed anyone over the age of 25 this summer. They go again in the Championship with much the same squad, and they are better equipped to stay up in what would be the 25-26 Premier League season.
It is a juicy fixture, this one, you know, taking aside potential impact on either manager if they were to lose. But it's really important if they want to just try and claw their way out of it that they get a victory, obviously, because of what Luton did last week against Crystal Palace. They obviously now have a 4-point advantage over Sheffield United in 18th. If either one could win, it would only be a 2 or a 3 point gap. So there is still hope, simply because there are, you know, there is one team outside of the relegation zone, which is not that far off.
I don't know if it says something about our kind of respective characters, but you say juicy, I say potentially one of the bleakest games in Premier League history.
Yeah.
Perhaps rivaling, do you remember that Reading against QPR when it was towards the end of the season, they drew 0-0, a result which resulted in both teams getting relegated. Mm. That's bleak.
It is bleak. But let's try and stay positive for both of these sides. Let's have a little bit of a prediction. Go on, if you don't mind, Tim.
No, I don't mind. I don't mind offering one up. It's more just, you know, what am I going to say? 1-0 Burnley.
1-0 Burnley.
I'm going to go similar. I'm going to go 2-1 Burnley.
Nick?
Attritional 1-1 draw.
Oh, okay. Right. Onwards and upwards then.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Right, let's have a look at some of the other maybe juicier fixtures this weekend. A couple of eye-catching ones. Arsenal against Wolves. Oh, Tim, How are you feeling about VAR? I mean, obviously, you know, Gary Ball has been hit hard by VAR. It has, though, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You just called me a moron on the podcast. Yeah. Wow, I like that. Yeah, fair play. Go on. No, but it's true, though. They have been probably the worst hit or the most unlucky in terms of VAR decisions. And Fulham was a case in point.
Yeah, I had a rare excursion into the away end on Monday night. This is only my second game as a fan for like almost a decade.
Yeah.
So I was quite reserved.
Are you a booer, Tim?
Yeah, I can be. Yeah, I was booing the ref on Monday night. But it's just, I don't know, I kind of despair really. The whole, and Wolves are an extreme example because of what's happening to them this season, but the whole night was just taken up by VAR. You know, there were the three penalty decisions, there were 16 minutes stoppage time. But the whole away end, like as soon as there was a contentious decision, like a throw-in, They were on the ref and the lino's back, like massively, and like singing about what they perceive as corruption in the Premier League, and you know, and then they're all just checking each other's phones for replays and tweets about whether the decisions were right or wrong, and then come the full time whistle, walking out the stadium, everybody was talking about it was VAR and the penalties. I was just like, this is not football. Like I said, I know Wolves are an extreme example, but I do kind of feel like every weekend, we, as in the, you know, the collective Premier League, we are just talking about decisions. It's just, I'm bored of it.
Talking about decisions before VAR.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, and that's exactly. I take your point, but
it's what we talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, but what's the point in all in putting ourselves through all this? The extreme delays, not being able to celebrate goals properly, if the decisions aren't going to be correct, that's the point. So at Craven Cottage on Monday, there were five big decisions. Three penalties, a potential red card for a headbutt, and a potential red card for Tim Ream's second booking. And then I got two right out of the five. I think it's fair enough to say. I think that's what the officials told Gary O'Neill afterwards. So what's the point in putting ourselves through all this if they're still nowhere near the high level that we now demand from them because they've got video evidence?
I don't mean to kind of riff on the pain at all, but there was something I found incredibly funny about Gary O'Neill very solemnly saying, I've now lost faith in VAR, like he was announcing the end of a marriage or something like that. We've tried so much, me and VAR, but it's just not happening.
But fair play to Gary O'Neill for still dealing with it in a diplomatic way. You compare that to how Mikel Arteta, you know, dealt with it, and they are poles apart in terms of Wolves as a team at the moment. Are you still content with what, you know, Gary Ball is?
I mean, there are fans and others and Gary Neal himself doing the maths and saying, look, if certain decisions had gone our way as they should have done, and this, of course, this isn't an exact science, then Wolves would be sort of around the Man United Newcastle portion of the Premier League. So yeah, you certainly can't argue with anything that he's doing at the moment.
And all the Wolves fans now on board.
Yeah, it's turned around very quickly. Yeah. There was a few weeks ago where they drew at Luton and lost to Ipswich in the Carabao Cup, and the tide was about to turn really, and then they beat Man City. But yeah, Arsenal away this weekend. So they've got both their first choice midfielders out suspended, Joe Gomez and Mario Lemina. So there was talk walking out of Craven Cottage on Monday night that Gary O'Neill might do a Mick McCarthy from 2009 when he selected an entirely different 11 away at Man United.
Oh, yes.
Because they had a more important game against Burnley at home a few days later, which is exactly what's happening now. Wolves have got Burnley at home on Tuesday night. The discourse was whether O'Neill would do a McCarthy.
Was there a punishment after that?
I think he got fined. It was a huge furore at the time.
Yeah.
Huge. People were calling for his sacking and all sorts.
Well, but partly because he just kind of pretended that nothing was... He just said, I just made some changes in the game.
Well,
what's the problem in the kind of classic Mick McCarthy way, which was incredibly funny.
Let's talk about Arsenal. Obviously, they're back top of the Premier League. They ground out a 1-0 win at Brentford last time out. And Kai Havertz did something significant, which is great for Arsenal fans. His position in that squad seems to be evolving in a positive way, Luke.
Yeah, I think that was the mood music from out of Arsenal. Almost as soon as he signed and it became clear that Mikel Arteta wanted to play him in midfield, that it was going to take some time for him to adapt to that sort of, you know, left eight role, as it were. And, you know, it wasn't surprising, you know, to me as someone that's watched quite a lot of Kai Havertz play, that he didn't take to that, you know, very naturally at the start of his Arsenal career. But he's kind of been helped by the fact that Arsenal, even though they as a team haven't been great performance wise, they've still got the results. You know, they're at the top of the Premier League and they're doing very well in the Champions League after their absolute demolition of Lens, in which Kai Havertz scored again. And I think they're in a very good position, they and Kai Havertz, to kind of keep developing under Arteta and keep pushing towards, you know, the big trophies, which is the kind of next step for them as a club.
Quick word on Chelsea against Brighton. Luke, I'll come back to you on this, because this is basically Chelsea against their feeder club. Is there a rivalry developing between these two sides? Is it as sort of tenuous as Crystal Palace, Brighton?
I don't think there's a rivalry developing. I think there's a little bit of embarrassment developing from a Chelsea perspective, because I think they lost twice to Brighton last season, and particularly the second time under Frank Lampard in April at Stamford Bridge was just like, it was a complete walkover for Brighton. They ambled to a 2-1 victory, and Ciso, I think, scored that goal of the season contender, if you remember. But there's no rivalry. I think for Chelsea fans, you know, there's a desire to beat Brighton, to almost be like, you know, we've spent all this money, we've bought some of their best players, we are actually better than them. And for Brighton, it's just, you know, we're here to upset the party, kind of doing things the right way, quote unquote, and playing good football. It'll be a very interesting tactical battle, I think, and Brighton might struggle, having been in, they'll be in Greece Thursday night, and then obviously playing Sunday at 2 p.m. UK time against Chelsea, who will have had a week's rest after getting embarrassed at Newcastle.
Yeah, why did it go quite so wrong against Newcastle?
I think, I mean, we joked about it earlier on the podcast, but I genuinely think, and you know, if you're a listener from outside of the UK, you may not understand that in the UK nowadays it gets dark at 4 p.m. and this was a Saturday 3 p.m. game, so it quite literally became St James's Park under the lights in the second half, and that is when Chelsea melted away. They were, you know, giving away silly fouls all game. Reece James got booked for kicking the ball away. So did Raheem Sterling. Cucurella got booked for dissent. They very much lost their heads in the second half. And I think they were overwhelmed a bit by Newcastle's press, which is obviously a key component under Eddie Howe. And most of his squad were fresh after the international break, albeit they had some injuries. And I think it's something that you have to accept with this Chelsea team, is that they're not going to be winning every game, and they're not going to be favourites for every game. And when you have a young squad, you know, be it Burnley or Chelsea, I think you just have to kind of accept that some weeks are just going to be terrible, and that's football. And I think a lot of Chelsea fans aren't accustomed to that. They're accustomed to winning every game and being favourites for every game, and that's not the normal existence for most football fans. So as I look at you three for nods in agreement.
Quick look at some of the other games. Obviously, there's some interesting games. Liverpool, Fulham, West Ham, Crystal Palace, Bournemouth, Villa, Brentford against Luton. Luton obviously going for back-to-back wins for the first time in the Premier League. And Forest against Everton. This is a really big one, isn't it? Because Forest are one of the low-hanging fruit, as we've discussed before. A little bit of pressure on Steve Cooper. And Everton, they will be looking for that first climb back, that first cut of those 10 points that they've so cruelly lost.
Mm, yeah, it could be a very emotional weekend for some people in this pod, me
you,
but basically,
yeah,
because I think there's a sort of assumption that if it doesn't go well for Forest, then Steve Cooper will be on his way. Yeah,
I don't, would you I cry? Don't know why. Would you actually cry?
Cry? No, you know what? I'm
I'm not going to cry because it's over. I'm just going to be happy that it happened.
Oh, Adam. Lovely.
Mm. The assumption is that this is going to happen at some point. The relationship between Steve Cooper and Forest owner Evangelos Marinakis isn't great. It feels like at this stage they're just sort of looking for a bit of an excuse, and that excuse would be, you know, losing a few games in a row. But, you know, Forest home form is really good, apart from, you know, the last game against Brighton was the first game they'd lost at home this season. So, you know, there may be kind of some kind of recovery, and Steve Cooper will still be there. But I suspect if not this weekend, it'll be relatively soon.
Which would be sad. And it would also sort of bring into the equation, well, what are you expecting us to do in terms of Forest? You know, you've come up from nowhere, you stayed up. What are you expecting? Anyway, we could talk about this. Maybe we'll have a dedicated Nottingham Forest podcast at some stage in the future. Let's just quickly talk before we go about the news out of IFAB this week that they're going to push ahead with further trials, maybe as high as the Premier League, maybe as soon as next season, by bringing in sin bins in football, just to add another element. It's a good idea, isn't it?
It sounds a bit farcical, really, doesn't it?
Do you think it does?
I don't know.
Because I was in the meeting. I was there. They held this meeting at Heathrow Airport so everyone could fly in. Pierluigi Collina was there and the various officials, Arsene Wenger was there and stuff. Then they did a press conference afterwards and we spoke to them. And my gut feeling was, well, yeah, if you can get rid of dissent and you can have an extra punishment, which isn't quite a red card for a tactical foul, then that's a good idea. Sin bin's not a bad idea. You're dead against it, are you?
I don't know. Tactical fouls are a great part of football. I don't think they should be punished with
So Chiellini pulling back Bukayo Saka, that was okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Fine.
It's fine. And the dissent thing, I mean, they tried that a few years ago. Do you remember when they said, oh, you can only talk to the captain? What happened to that? Why can't we try that again?
That's part of that. That's one of them. I think these are quite good ideas, but I've heard a lot of negative views about these new additions.
I think I wrote a piece about this this week, and I think in theory, if it works with no complications, then yes, in theory it could reduce dissent towards referees and whatever else. But even just kind of sitting around in the office, we came up with a number of things that meant it could just make the game more complicated and basically be a sort of net negative. Like, for example, you get a player sin bin for 10 minutes in the second half, there's going to be some turbo time wasting in that 10 minutes.
One other quick thing that was mentioned, and this is something that they're thinking about to try and eradicate time wasting from goalkeepers, is instead of giving an indirect free kick in the box, to give a corner, which I thought was actually quite a good idea.
Yeah,
I think that's an easy fix.
I think it seems overly complicated to me.
Hold on a minute.
But how complicated is that? That's really not complicated.
This gets said about every new football rule, and it always turns out to be far more complicated than people.
But I think
imagine,
that's a very straightforward thing, isn't it?
Sure.
If the goalkeeper, you start the clock, right? 10 seconds gone. Bosh. Corner.
The other thing is that the implication is that a conceding corner is more of a punishment than an indirect free kick in the box.
No. It's the other way around. They felt that an indirect free kick in the penalty box is too much of a punishment, and that's why referees were more reluctant to give it.
Right.
But the
okay.
corner is actually a better halfway house between the two.
But
Can I say, speaking as someone that has been sin binned playing football, in the
because they do it at grassroots football, yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's great at grassroots level, and it genuinely made me rethink.
What did you do?
One was quite a bad tactical foul, and okay. one was a strong challenge that I think was erroneously given as a sin bin. The tactical foul one I have no complaints about, and it genuinely made me think, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore. So to that extent, it does work, but I think there's way too much controversy that can be had over, you know, the interpretation of what's a sin bin versus what's a yellow card versus what's a red card, you know, both ways. So I think it's great at grassroots level when you want to eradicate, you know, bad things like time wasting and things like dissent, which are a lot harder to police at that level. But at Premier League level, professional level, I don't think it will work.
Okay.
But we admire your enthusiasm.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And you know what? Let's think about this, right? everyone's saying, oh, God, the games are going on so long. Oh, no, we're going to have to spend more time at the football. Well, you're going to the football anyway. You may as well go to the football and spend more time at the football. You're getting more bang for your buck. You're spending more time with your mates at the football. And there's more for us to talk about as well. Do you agree? You do all. You're all nodding at me. Thank you very much.
None of us are nodding.
No one's nodding. No one's nodding.
Adam is abusing his position as the host.
Playing devil's advocate to the nth degree. This week. Right. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks.
Luke, thank you.
A pleasure as always.
And Nick, thank you as always.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for today. Io is going to be back on Monday. We will be back with another Premier League weekend preview next Friday. And if you want to join the Athletic family, you can sign up for £1.99 or dollars a month for an entire year at theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks very much for listening and enjoy your weekend, and wrap up very warm because it's going to be very cold if you are listening to this in the UK.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.